Radiotopia.
Welcome to the Kitchen Sisters present.
From PRX.
We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson
and Nikki Silva.
Hi, I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life in prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. The Kitchen Sisters Present is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Some very important authority was once asked, what was Irving Berlin's impact on American music? And this person said, Irving Berlin didn't have an impact on American music. Irving Berlin was American music. And by the same token, you could say, you know, Ada Louise was architecture criticism. She really embodied it. She is the mother of us all.
Today, the Kitchen Sisters present Ada Louise Huxtable, The Art We Must Live With, produced by Brandy Howell for the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation's podcast, New Angle Voice, with host Cynthia Krakauer.
Anyone who writes about American architecture of the mid-20th and early 21st centuries measures their critical achievement with the yardstick drawn by Ada Louise Huxtable. With countless articles for two great daily newspapers, this petite New Yorker had a gigantic influence on our understanding of the work of architects, real estate developers, city bureaucrats, and the city itself over the course of six decades in print. General readers are quite accustomed to having their choices in books, films, dance, opera, drama, TV, and music directed and influenced by critics' opinions. We find our favorite interpreters, trust their judgments, buy books, buy tickets. But in the concrete jungle of the city, we are captives. We have no choice to ignore what is built by others to house us for our workplaces, our transit systems, our public realm. The ubiquity of mediocre architecture dulls the senses. And yet, when architecture achieves greatness, it can exalt the human spirit. Ada Louise Huxtable set out to separate the dull from the great. A few architects tried to argue with her. They never won. With her impeccable civic values, cultivated aesthetic sensibility, and lacerating accuracy, she both praised and raised. Listen now to The Art We Must Live With. Ada Louise Huxtable and Architecture Criticism.
Ada Louise sent me an email. Calatrava had been announced as the architect of the Fulton Street Transit Hub. She said, Calatrava, Schmalatrava. You like that kind of architecture as engineering? Pierluigi Nervi is the real deal. As it happens, there's an example in New York. He designed the George Washington bus terminal. Well, you could have knocked me down with a feather. It's like telling me Frank Lloyd Wright had done Port Authority. She said, I want to go up there. Would you mind coming with me? I got a company car, picked her up. We go up to the bus terminal. There was a Duane Reade right across the street. And she said, would you mind going in there and getting one of these disposable cameras? And I said, sure. But, you know, it's quite a, shall we say, colorful neighborhood up there. And I figured, you know, she'd invited me to be her escort. And I said, yes, I'll get it, but you're staying in the car until I get back. Come back to the car, no Ada Louise. I think, great. Going to the bus terminal, no Ada Louise. I find her somewhere in the depths of the building. She's opening and closing doors, racing all around. This is a woman in her 80s. She's got more energy than me at this point. We go out into the platform where you actually board the buses. The girders holding up the terminal, there are set in these huge concrete footings. Ada Louise wanted me to help her climb on top of one of these so she could get a better look at the coffering. I said, absolutely not. You are staying right here. That's when I realized how relevant the title of her book was, Kick to Building Lately, because she really did. When she was on assignment, she wanted to go straight into the lion's den. My name's Eric Gibson. I'm the editor of the Arts and Review section of the Wall Street Journal. I've been in this position for 20 years, the first 10 of which was my great pleasure and privilege to be Ada Louise Huxtable's editor.
Our guest tonight is Mrs. Ada Louise Huxtable, architectural critic of the New York Times. Mrs. Huxtable, being an architecture critic is an unusual profession. How did you get to do this kind of work?
Well, I think the need grew up before the people came for the jobs. There are many publications now anxious to have architecture critics, and there are just very few people with the training. My training was really self-made. I'm an informally educated critic. I'm an architectural historian, and I've always been interested in the city, in all cities.
I've written things where you have to prove that a building was important in the past, so I'll just go to the New York Times archive and look up Ada Louise Huxtable and the name of that building. If she wrote about it and I can stick in a quote from her, then people, you know, believe that it was important. She almost became a kind of shorthand. I'm Alexandra Lang. I'm an architecture and design critic. And my mom actually gave me my first Ada Louise Huxtable book when I was in high school. I'd already expressed an interest in being an architect at that point, and she thought, oh, you should really read, you know, the most famous architecture critic in the country, who happens to be a woman, before you decide to go on this path.
I think it's the greatest of the arts because it is such a complex art. It's the art we must live with. You want to experience painting or sculpture, it's an option. But there is absolutely nothing optional about your experience of architecture.
My name is Carrie Jacobs, and I write about architecture and design in cities for a variety of magazines. I also teach at a program at the School of Visual Arts.
Currently crossing 58th Street, we're heading south on the east side of Park Avenue.
Ada Louise Huxtable is kind of in the air and in the water in New York City.
We are standing in front of what was Pepsi's headquarters. The very last building on.
She wrote in 1961 this tiny little skinny book for walking tours of modern architecture in New York City. One of the walking tours was Park Avenue.
And I always start from the last building because it's my favorite by Natalie DeBlois of Skid Row.
I have long been of the opinion that Park Avenue is a really boring street. And so I'd never really thought about it that much as a place, but the tour completely changed my perspective. It was like a mild hallucinogen, one that just kind of enhances.
The stars of this tour.
You see like little Bieber rainbows House, around everything.
I'm Paul Goldberger. I was architecture critic of the New York Times for many years. I was Ada Louise's colleague and then became her successor. She sort of always treated New York as a child she loved but was very disappointed in. And, you know, just I'm only saying this because I love you. You can do better. If you had to sum up everything she had to say about New York, it would come down to those lines.
Your ability to set some sense of taste in New York City and the kinds of crusades you've been involved in maintaining some of our landmarks have been very notable. I think the people in New York City owe you a real debt of gratitude. Are you a New Yorker or a visiting fireman?
Oh, no, I'm a native New Yorker. I was born here, educated here, grew up here. I belong to New York very much.
My name is Christine Cipriani, and I'm writing a biography of Ada Louise Huxtable. Ada Louise had a fairly quiet childhood on the Upper West Side. She was born in 1921. She described it as a happy childhood, but it clearly had some shadows there. Her father died when she was 11. When he died, she was alone, the only child of a single mom, who was not entirely in sync with her own developing interests. So she really made her own way intellectually. As her mom began to give her more freedom, she began to walk and roller skate around the city. One by one, she would explore new landmarks. There is an adorable photograph of her with bootless roller skates strapped onto her Mary Janes. She enrolled in Hunter College because there was really no money for her to consider going anywhere else. While she was in college, she and a friend entered an interior design contest sponsored by Bloomingdale's. They won first prize. After she graduated and couldn't find a job as an art teacher, she decided to write a letter to the president of Bloomingdale's saying, "I've just won your contest, and I wonder if you could find a job for me in your store." He interviewed her himself, and he offered her a job selling modern furniture. Garth Huxtable was an industrial designer. He trained in the 1930s, primarily with Norman Bel Geddes. Garth designed every household object from pens to ink wells to refrigerators, tools. He came in to buy a chest of drawers. She overcharged him by mistake. He asked her out to dinner. They were engaged a month later. He was a talented guy, soft-spoken and kind and courteous, but he also had a little bit of dash, and I think Ada Louise responded to that combination. They would host dinner parties. They hosted a little coronation party when Queen Elizabeth was crowned, and they used to tool around in their car a lot. They would go out to Long Island. They would go to the Hudson Valley. While she was at Bloomingdale's, she began to take graduate courses at NYU's Institute of Fine Arts. She began working part-time at the Museum of Modern Art for Philip Johnson. She got to meet a lot of movers and shakers in the world of architecture and absorb Johnson's process, got to know people like Alfred Barr and Henry Russell Hitchcock. So for her, I think it was an exciting time because she was studying history at the Institute of Fine Arts and really seeing it unfold at MoMA at the same time. In 1950, she went to Italy as a Fulbright scholar, and she did independent research on the Rationalists and other contemporary Italian work. When she got back to New York, she curated a show at MoMA called The Modern Movement in Italy. Her very first published article was a slightly expanded version of her exhibition text for that show. After that, she began publishing more in architecture and art trade magazines. And she gradually, over the course of the 50s, began building a portfolio as a writer. Alongside that, she was helping Garth with his business, which was growing as an independent industrial designer.
Ada Louise was part of the expansion and professionalization of mass media arts coverage. That was something that only started after World War II. There was a great museum boom, and you had things like Leonard Bernstein doing the young people's concerts. There was a great curiosity. The arts coverage in newspapers was mostly on the society page, and editors woke up. They realized they couldn't have the society columnist writing about a museum opening anymore. They needed a professional.
Aline Saarinen, who'd been writing about art for a long time, when she married Eero Saarinen, she recused herself from covering most architecture, and her editor, Lester Merkel, knew that he had a problem. So in the 1950s, he tried to find another architecture writer. Ada Louise was one of the names that was eventually mentioned as someone he should look at. In 1957, she saw an article on architecture that she thought was poorly written. She fires off a long article-length letter to the editor. To her amazement, they printed the whole thing, and that got her back into the office, and that got her a commission.
There was no architecture critic. In fact, when I started writing for the New York Times and when Clifton Daniel asked me to do the job full-time, he said, "What shall we call you?" And we decided that it was architecture critic.
part of the reason Ada Louise is upset that the New York Times isn't covering architecture better is that there is so much architecture to cover. It's this real boom period in New York City. The old residential buildings built in the 20s and 30s are coming down and being replaced by these glass skyscrapers. The city is being transformed by money and the post-war boom. And she feels like we need to talk about it. We need to have smart people who understand what this actually means and aren't just kind of goggling at the buildings.
December 15th, 1957, published in the Sunday New York Times Magazine. It's called the Park Avenue School of Architecture, and the subtitle is Business and Its New Sleek and Shiny Temples Have Transformed a Famous Residential Street. There's a paragraph that's just always been my favorite. The revolution is a post-war miracle, brought about by unprecedented prosperity, which in turn spurred a great building boom. The chief sponsors of the new office buildings were and are conservative commercial corporations, whose names read like a preferred listing of who's who in American industry. The staples of our civilization, soap, whiskey, and chemicals, have identified themselves with advanced architectural design, and their monuments march up the avenue in a proud parade.
There's a letter from Frank Lloyd Wright to the editor of the New York Times. The very first column she ever wrote elicited this letter, who said, "You better watch this girl, she's terrific."
After there's this growing understanding within the New York Times that they need someone to cover architecture, they do create a new job, and she is hired in 1963 to fill it. She very soon becomes a popular byline.
My name is Christopher Hawthorne. I spent almost 15 years as the architecture critic at the Los Angeles Times. One of the great symbols of her influence was this cartoon that was published in the New Yorker about 5 years or so into her tenure as the critic at the New York Times, which showed a bunch of construction workers at a site with steel frame of a skyscraper rising behind them. And one of them says, "Ada Louise Huxtable already doesn't like it," which I think is a fantastic way to capture her influence. How many architecture critics have cartoons about them? How many architecture critics would it be plausible to think that construction workers would be talking about and name-checking? She had it framed in her apartment and also had it embroidered on a pillow, which I think is also a really funny example of her sense of humor, not taking herself too seriously, but also kind of reminding people of that influence and her kind of place in the pecking order.
The great thing about that cartoon is it also turned up in an episode of Mad Men, which basically you should have heard the shrieks of architecture critics across America when it turns up in Mad Men, because like that never happens. This is Ada Louise Huxtable's obituary for Penn Station, published in the New York Times in July 1966. A vision of Rome dies. Pennsylvania Station succumbed to progress this week at the age of 56 after a lingering decline. The building's one remaining facade was shorn of eagles and ornament yesterday, preparatory to leveling the last wall. It went not with a bang or a whimper, but to the rustle of real estate stock shares. The passing of Penn Station is more than the end of a landmark. Pennsylvania Station was designed by McKim, Mead, and White, the great Beaux-Arts architects of America. Some New Yorkers wanted to build a new arena, Madison Square Garden, and they thought, oh, we can just knock down Penn Station, put it in the basement, and build the arena on top. There was a huge outcry, public protests, letters, getting politicians involved. But part of the modernist credo is really that we have to always be moving forward, that we should have a building that is suited to the times. And so a lot of modern architects aren't that interested in preservation. You could make the argument that Penn Station was outdated for 1960s travel. it was necessary for a lot of people to turn around and say, but wait, the new architecture is only good when there's old architecture there too. These things all work in concert to make a beautiful city. That's where you get these really interesting groups of advocates, some of whom are modern architects, some of whom are curators, Philip Johnson, Jane Jacobs, Aileen Saarinen, saying, this is a beautiful building, we need to save it. Ada Louise Huxtable was very supportive of their efforts and wrote a number of pieces about saving Penn Station, and then they failed.
It went far beyond actually losing a station. It really was a sense of what is the city and how do you have that resonance, really, that you get from the past that makes the city rich and real and a rewarding place to be, that it isn't sterile. It isn't the product of building by the bottom line, which, of course, so much construction is.
It was torn down bit by bit, starting in the early 60s. Many architects came out and decried its demolition to no effect, but it did lead New York City to establish the landmarks law. My name is Kathleen McGuigan. I'm an architecture critic and editor. For many years, I was the critic at Newsweek magazine, and after that, I spent almost a dozen years as the editor-in-chief of Architectural Record.
What she was trying to do was make people aware of why this had happened and how bad it was. It was an interesting dance she had to do to sort of engage people's attention while discussing these very legalistic matters. She was pushing to get a landmarks law passed, and the process of that happening was like molasses. It took years of hard work by many different activists. She was beating the drum at every stage. This is what needs to happen. This is what needs to happen. And this is why. And let me explain to you that Penn Station was lost on a technicality. That was probably quite tedious for her, but it needed to be done. There was no one else doing it. There was no one explaining to people how the laws affect what you see in front of you.
It was a first. It was a consciousness raiser. It really started the preservation movement in New York. It gave it legs. And before that, nobody had any influence except the builders.
Ada Louise Huxtable, she was a critic who was able to embrace a vast array of different kinds of architecture and different kinds of propositions about architecture. She really cared about preservation, but she didn't think that you should preserve things exactly as they once were. Cities and buildings evolve. She wrote an absolutely damning piece about colonial Williamsburg. This was for the New York Review of Books, which really may have been one of the first places where I ever saw the word, the Disneyfication of places. She may have actually coined it in that article.
Well, I think this is so American. We have given the surrogate, the unreal substitute, more authenticity, more respect than the real thing. Americans traditionally like their things new and shiny and full of romance and atmosphere, and real old places aren't like that.
She really had to assert herself in a way that men did not have to, but she was this tiny little woman who got heard.
She stood up against the power block of the AIA, all men at that point, Belusky and Gropius, and held her own.
When Ada Louise walked into the newsroom, everything stopped. She was just so beautifully turned out that all the heads turned. She was a great presence. You were aware of this immense intellect and the twinkle in the eye, too. You always knew something was going on up there.
I remember once complimenting her on a dress she was wearing, and she said, oh, that's just an old Holston. She did not want it to be the most important thing about her, and it wasn't, but she always looked perfect anyway. She was a person of extraordinary style, but she was a person of even greater substance, her writing and her mind and what she had to say.
In addition to her enormous talent, Ada Louise had a certain amount of good fortune in her career. She got her job at the Times at age 42. She had the confidence of having a solid 20 years of studying architectural history and then writing about architecture. She walked into the job that she wanted at the time. She did not have to come in a junior position and climb a greasy pole.
She identified very much as a woman, and yet at the same time, she did not identify particularly with women as a group at the New York Times. There were a couple of women, of whom she was one, who had become quite successful before the, for want of a better word, I'll say surge of feminism, began to open up more positions to women.
Most women at newspapers at that time really were stymied in their efforts to get better assignments, get promoted, get paid equally. And of course, they just weren't hired in the same numbers, or they were asked to do women's news. She had bypassed a lot of those obstacles.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Nan Robertson loved the newspaper she wrote for 33 years, the New York Times. But that didn't stop her from suing the paper in 1974. Robertson was part of a group of female employees that charged the Times with systematic sex discrimination. The lawsuit was settled out of court in 1978.
There was a very famous lawsuit against the Times. She was one of the few women who did not participate in it. And I think there was some friction over the years between her and many of the women who did.
The city room of the Times, a vast block-long room, there was row after row of men, and then in the middle were the five women, seated together. This island of women in a sea of men, as everybody described it.
When the women at the Times began to push for equal treatment in the 1970s, Ada Louise felt that she was not in a position to agitate because she herself had been very well taken care of. And so there were people who resented her for them.
I'm Meredith Clausen, architectural historian. They really applied a great deal of pressure to her because she was one of the major women higher up than most. So there was a great deal of pressure to join the troops, and she refused. Her support at that early stage would have really carried a lot of weight, and people knew that. But she didn't. She was very, very clear in her, nope, reject, thank you, no, resign, no, can't make it, declined. And it only was gradual that she came around to the cause. There was a lot of stress, daily deadlines. That was certainly one thing. It was also salaries in the early 70s. And she complained very openly, straightforwardly, bluntly, and said, my salary is just too low. She was very outspoken about that. So it was a conjunction of a lot of things. I think the MacArthur Fellowship indeed allowed her to leave that behind and concentrate on the things that she wanted.
In 81, she was named to the first class of MacArthur Fellows. She really left when she got the fellowship and did not return to the paper.
Ultimately, she was very unhappy at the New York Times because they started trying to rein her in and trying to get her to not write against developers.
I'm Julie Jovine. I wrote about architecture and design for the New York Times. Well, Ada Louise was not part of the Girls of the Balcony vocally. She was part of that group and that generation of women reporters. She very much experienced the New York Times treatment of women, even though she was like one of the most famous writers there. She told me they made her cry all the time. And the day she got the MacArthur, she quit.
The political climate at the New York Times changed a lot between the late 60s and the late 70s. Ada Louise internally lost some of her pillars of support. In the world outside the paper, architecture was also changing, and the modern work that she had championed in the 60s and that she had worked so hard to bring to people's attention and help people appreciate had fallen out of favor with a new young generation of architects and thinkers. The work that they were producing was something that she did not often connect with. So between the political situation inside the Times and the architectural situation outside the Times, I think the late 70s were a difficult time for her.
Of course, when she left the Times and she'd been out from there a short time, the Wall Street Journal snapped her right up. Eric Gibson, who was her editor and ultimately my editor, was so thrilled.
The phrase Ada Louise's editor is something of an oxymoron because pro that she was, not only did she file on time, but her copy was pretty much pristine. And whatever we did was always received both graciously and gratefully. if anyone could have played the diva card, it was Ada Louise. Never did. Over time, we developed a relationship. She would invite me to tea to plan out the fall coverage. Those were always great sessions because they were sort of 9/10 gossip and 1/10 fall planning. I have a letter here that she shared with me. 2003, 4 or 5 designs for Ground Zero were presented. And one of them was a collaborative effort of Gwathmey, Peter Eisenman, Lord Foster. It was nicknamed the Tic-Tac-Toe Building because it was really quite pedestrian looking. It was this gridded structure. Ada Louise said to me in the run-up to a review of these projects, she said, this thing is so bad. I'm going to talk about all of them, but I'm just going to leave it out because it's really kinder to ignore it than to say what needs to be said. I said, absolutely, because in criticism, sometimes the most powerful judgment is ignoring something. So at our fall session in 2003, she showed me a letter that had been sent to her on the 8th of January, 2003, from Richard Meyer and Partners Architects. And it read as follows. Dear Ada Louise, for years we have had great respect for your work and have harbored the belief that the admiration was mutual. It was therefore difficult to comprehend that your omission of even acknowledging our proposal for the World Trade Center site in your Wall Street Journal article was done with malice. Perhaps your editor cut your article. Perhaps you turned off your TV. Whatever the reason, it was hurtful to Stephen Hole, Charles Gwathmey, Peter Eisenman, myself, and to all the members of our team who believe that this is our city and it is our responsibility to bring the art of modern architecture back to the consciousness of the public domain. Sincerely yours, Richard Meyer. So I read that with a chuckle, and she turned to me, and in her inimitable way, she said, Richard Meyer, get a life.
I remember she once said, oh, it's so much fun to have somebody to gossip about architecture with, which she really delighted in. You know, what did you think of so-and-so's new building? Isn't it awful? Or isn't it great? Or how did so-and-so get that job? Or, you know, what is Philip Johnson up to now? And rolling her eyes.
We started communicating by email because I was writing a lot for the Architects newspaper. She would send me little notes. It turns out she was an incredible insomniac. Her emails were coming at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., She pursued everything constantly. I mean, she was up to date. She was very curious. And since I was working at this trade, she was very eager to know about what was going on in the field, who was doing new, interesting work, what were the projects that were going to really make a difference. She invited me over for tea to her apartment. It was like a mini penthouse on Park Avenue. It was really beautiful. We'd start with tea. And would stay so long, would turn into drinks.
I had a friend from Paris who was visiting, and I said, I want to make a little dinner party for you. My friend said, oh, I invited Ada Louise Huxtable to your house for dinner. And I went into a complete and total panic. She came to our door. It was winter, and she's tiny. And I took off her fur coat for her, which weighed more than she did. I don't even know how she held it up. And she came into our living room, and my husband offered her a martini. And she looked really tempted, though she ended up declining. But it launched this great conversation about how she had helped her husband, Garth Huxtable, design the martini glasses and all the glassware and all the flatware and everything for the Four Seasons restaurant.
Every summer, Ada Louise went up to Marblehead, Massachusetts. She loved it up there. She would round up all of her boxes of research and stay there till September, October. I took my kids up to Maine every summer. We would always stop by. She made sure that my boys got the right kind of brownies and their favorite flavor of ice cream. I would bring her blueberries, and we would have a little party on the porch. My kids, who have been exposed to a lot of architecture, but are not all that interested in it, would suddenly sit up and take attention when Ada Louise would suddenly burst out with some profanity over the doings of some architect who should have known better. She would not spare her language.
I'm Stuart Denenberg, and I am a private art dealer. I was very privileged to become a family friend of Ada Louise Huxtable. And in the course of our friendship and toward the end of her life, she asked me to organize and place her archive. We were able to find a home for the archive at the Getty Research Institute. My big sister, Sandy Kanoski, one day she called and said, you know, next time you're in town, you've got to meet somebody I've met who writes books on art. I said, oh, who's that? She said, I don't remember her last name. It's Ada Louise something. Well, there's only one Ada Louise. It's Ada Louise Huxtable, yes? Yeah, that's her name. That's right. I said, Sandy, how did you meet Ada Louise Huxtable? You know, she's the foremost architecture critic in the world. We met sailing, she said. Sandy, you get seasick. You don't like to sail. Oh, no, no. Yard sailing.
The garage sales. She collected old wicker furniture, which was absolutely charming in her place. And she had rows and rows of glassware because she liked to have people over and entertain in a very casual way. Nothing matched, by the way. It was like stuff that she inherited or collected. She had a very normal life. My name is Beverly Denenberg. I'm Stuart Denenberg's wife and partner in Denenberg Fine Arts and historic preservationist art dealer and very dear friend of Ada Louise.
She was this very high-low person. She told us that when she had dinner with the King of Spain, she prided herself on wearing a 50-cent pin she bought at a yard sale.
Her books, Skyscrapers, New York. For me, Ada Louise was a kind of my education about the United States. My name is Maristella Casciato. I'm a senior curator at the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles, and I'm specifically the head of the architectural collection. In my position, I supervise Ada Louise Huxtable Archive, and I help scholars to look through her papers. Now, let me tell you something about the archive. The archive reached the Getty in Los Angeles in 2013, basically a few months after Ada Louise passed away. She had been in contact with our director.
One day she turned to us and she said, you've worked with estates, could you work with mine? And we said we would be honored.
The archive was meticulous, well-organized condition.
She took us into the second bedroom, which was her office, and behind the sofa beds, so elegantly and meticulously organized, were file cabinets filled with letters and photographs.
She was really thinking about the future of research, the future of the profession of the architectural critic. She had decided already that the Getty Research Institute would be a perfect location for her archive. First of all, she loved the Getty. She was a member of the consulting committee for the construction of this campus. So she really knew this place from the ground up. So there was not a big question. But at a certain moment, there was the need to rush because she got very sick. The archive is the archive of her work for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Pritzker Committee, postcards. We have her email, 45 boxes in the correspondence. Nasty letters, very critical. Phil Johnson, Durrell Stone was definitely not her favorite architect. But all this, it's always done with a clear mind. The critic constructs the context. If you want to study architecture, you need to hear all the voices around, and that's what she offers.
The last piece that she wrote was about the potential destruction of the New York Public Library. This idea to do a radical renovation of its main building, which is another neoclassical building designed by Carrera and Hastings. They wanted to pull out the old cast iron stacks. They wanted to pull out the old floors and insert what we would now refer to as Apple Store style architecture. People were just horrified. How can a library, which, among other things, preserves thousands of years of literary tradition, have so little respect for their own architecture?
The key to this was her willingness to do her homework, that the stacks under the Rose Reading Room were structural.
We invited New York Public Library President Anthony Marks to address some of the questions. Welcome back to our show, Tony. The late Ada Louise Huxtable, in her last essay for the Wall Street Journal, quoted an engineer saying it was like cutting the legs off a table while dinner was being served.
Well, not my favorite quote. We're going to do this, right?
We did love
her. We're going to do it absolutely safely. The stacks would not be removed until the new structure
is in place. She wrote, "A research library is a timeless repository of treasures, not a popularity contest measured by headcounts. This is already the most democratic of institutions, free and open to all. Democracy and populism seem to have become hopelessly confused." She was talking about everything being undervalued, the structure, the original architecture, and the role of the library in civic life.
Being able to write that when you're 91 is pretty fantastic. I mean, boy, did she go out swinging. That was one of the great farewells of all time in any career whatsoever. She knew when to play all the cards in her hand, and she did.
It was the one real marathon we had. That May, as she was getting ready to go to Marblehead, she said, "I want to work on this New York Public Library piece." She goes to Marblehead, and I get these emails from her saying, I've emailed the library for plans, any information they can give me, and I'm being completely stonewalled. I was used to not hearing from her very often during the summers, but this particular summer, I became concerned because I didn't hear from her for longer than usual. When she got back, she mentioned to me that it had been a very difficult trip. By this time, I knew she was ill with cancer. That summer, she'd been in Mass General and almost had not come out.
Everybody knew she wasn't well, and everybody was waiting for this Wall Street Journal article on the library.
November. Anthony Marks has just gotten in touch with her. "Dear Ada Louise, I have only just learned of your interest in our project. I would so love to show you the plans." She was beside herself. She said, "Eric, I can't do this. It's too late. It's on the presses." I knew we were in the final approach. Her voice was different. I knew the end was close. So I thought, we got to get this out. We get it into print. A week later is the press conference at the library where Anthony Marks and Foster make the presentation. Then they open it up to questions. The first questioner asks Foster, "Why don't you just do what Ada Louise Huxtable said you should do?" He was furious. It really was a transformative piece. You can probably count on the fingers of one hand the works of arts criticism that have really made a difference. This was one because just over a year later, the library announced that it was scrapping the plan. It was a great triumph of hers, and it was done in the teeth of terminal illness. She died about a week after that press conference. It made me realize that this piece had kept her alive. She was determined to get that piece done before she left this mortal coil, and boy, she went out with a bang.
Ada Louise is the beacon and the gold standard for anybody writing about architecture and urbanism today. Nobody has ever done it better. Putting buildings in context was something that we've all learned to do later, but she was a real pioneer about that, talking about the economics and the politics of real estate, as well as the aesthetics of the building. It's not a regular part of what critics undertake anymore, and I think that's a shame because we're very much caught up in a world of public-private partnerships where developers are really deciding what our cities look like. You just long for her to have been here when Hudson Yards opened. I just would love to have heard her on that.
We see an awful lot of bad buildings, and I guess my life has been devoted, or a good part of it, to trying to say we have entitlements, we deserve better than this.
A lot of architects have lost their sense of humanity. This is for people. It's for people, and that's the role of the critic.
Special thanks in this episode to the generous architectural critics, Alexandra Lang, Kathleen McGuigan, Christopher Hawthorne, Julie Iovine, Carrie Jacobs, Christine Cipriani, and Paul Goldberger. All achieved their craft, following the inimitable example set by Ada Louise Huxtable. Historian Meredith Clausen, Wall Street Journal editor Eric Gibson, and the Huxtable Archive team of Stuart and Beverly Denenberg, and from the Getty Center, Maristella Casciato. Everyone was exceedingly helpful. This podcast is produced by Brandy Howell, with editorial advising from Alexandra Lang. Thanks also to production assistant Virginia Eskridge. New Angle Voice is brought to you by the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation. Funding for this podcast comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Graham Foundation.
This is a great line if you want to have a really stinging. And in 1971, she wrote about the opening of the Kennedy Center in Washington by Edward Durell Stone. The building is a national tragedy. It is a cross between a concrete candy box and a marble sarcophagus in which the art of architecture lies buried. Woo!
For New Angle Voice, I'm your host, Cynthia Krakauer.
Thank you, Cynthia Krakauer and New Angle Voice, for sharing this story with us. And thank you to Brandy Howell, who produced this story and is part of our team here at the Kitchen Sisters. You can hear more of their stories about pioneering women architects at bwa.org. The Kitchen Sisters Present is produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Brandy Howell and Nathan Dalton. We're part of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of podcasts created by independent producers, some of the best stories out there.
Radiotopia. From PRX.